Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
It's 6 a.m. in Shanghai, 4 p.m. in Mexico City, and 6 p.m. here in New York. I'm Julia Chatterley, and wherever you are in the world, this is your First Move. A warm welcome to First Move, as always, and here's today's Need to Know. Don't. U.S. President Joe Biden's message to Iran, even as he warns about an attack on Israeli targets happening sooner than later. Shohei Ohtani's former translator surrendering to authorities after allegedly stealing $16 million from the baseball superstar. And tremendous Tiger. Tiger Woods becomes the first player ever to make 24 consecutive cuts at the Masters in Augusta. All that and plenty more coming up. But first, a warning from President Biden to Iran ahead of a potential attack on U.S. or Israeli assets in the Middle East. Don't.
We are devoted to the defense of Israel. We will support Israel. We will help defend Israel. And Iran will not succeed.
The president also said he expects it will happen sooner than later. U.S. intelligence has been warning of Iran's potential retaliation after a strike on in the Iranian consulate in Syria last week. Israel's defense minister says the commander of U.S. Central Command was in Israel discussing preparations for the anticipated attack.
I recently met with U.S. CENTCOM commander General Kurilla, a true friend of Israel. We discussed the close cooperation between the United States and Israel, between our defense establishments and our militaries. Our enemies think that they can pull apart Israel and the United States, but the opposite is true. They are bringing us together and strengthening our ties. We stand shoulder to shoulder in our struggle.
It's an open question, though, whether or not any attack will come on Israeli soil and whether it will come directly from Iranian forces or from their proxies in the region. Jeremy Diamond is in Jerusalem for us. Jeremy, Israel, the United States clearly bracing, strategizing about potential retaliation. We're also hearing that the United States is also moving more assets. We don't know what. They've been nonspecific into the region as well. The fear more generally is whatever happens here results in some kind of retaliation, which Iran has long tried to avoid too. It leaves very little options.
Yeah, no question about it. This is a very tense moment and a potential inflection point in this conflict that has been going on for 6 months now. And amid all of those 6 months, we have been waiting to see whether or not this could potentially explode into a broader regional conflict. And we may now be meeting that moment of truth. Tonight, Israeli forces are on high alert, anticipating a potential Iranian attack in response for that Israeli strike on an Iranian consular facility in Damascus, Syria, that killed a high-ranking Iranian commander. The chief of staff of the Israeli military today saying that Israeli forces are prepared and ready to respond to any threat. Already tonight, a barrage of 40 rockets was fired by Hezbollah, all of those intercepted by Israel's air defense system, or some of those rockets also falling in open areas. That is not the response that we are anticipating from Iran and its proxy forces to that strike in Damascus. Damascus. It was, though, one of the most significant barrages that we have seen Hezbollah fire. Now, the question is, where and when will that potential Iranian response come? I'm told that Israeli officials are preparing for a potential Iranian attack on Israeli facilities inside of Israel. And of course, an Iranian attack on Israeli soil would potentially trigger something much more serious. That's because Israeli officials have been telegraphing that any response will be in kind, meaning an Iranian attack on Israeli soil will result in an Israeli response on Iranian soil. Now, amid all of this, we are still very closely monitoring the humanitarian situation in Gaza. And we know that the United States has been bringing enormous pressure to bear on Israel on that front. And we're now starting to see Israel ratcheting up the amount of humanitarian aid that's actually able to enter the Gaza Strip.
Rami Attar has been waiting 2 months for this single box of humanitarian aid, cans of meat and vegetables to feed his family of seven. This will be gone in 10 days, he says, his frustration unmistakable. I don't know how it's going to be enough for seven people. I've been suffering here, being stuck for the last 6 to 7 months, and the UN hasn't brought me anything to at least satiate my hunger. 6 months into the war, famine is creeping into parts of Gaza. Humanitarian aid agencies have been sounding the alarm for months. But now, amid ramped-up U.S. pressure, Israel is suddenly taking major steps to increase humanitarian aid. We plan to flood Gaza with aid, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said this week, describing a new phase of humanitarian assistance that will see more aid flow into Israel's port of Ashdod and into Gaza via a new northern crossing point. Overnight, the first trucks of food aid crossing into northern Gaza via that new crossing point. Israel says it has nearly doubled the number of humanitarian aid trucks getting into Gaza over the last week, screening close to 400 trucks per day.
We're dealing with the wrong part of the system.
Jamie McGoldrick, the UN's humanitarian coordinator, says it's clear Israel is suddenly shifting its approach to humanitarian aid.
Well, that's for sure. I mean, there has been a change. We've been asking for this for months. The fact that we've asked for more, say, Kerem Shalom to be open longer. We've asked for more routes in, a corridor from Jordan. We've asked for all of the things they're now starting to say they're going to give us. But ask the question, why didn't we get it before?
For months, Israeli leaders have rejected accusations that they are limiting aid into Gaza or intentionally starving its population.
Well, our policy is not to have famine, but to have the entry of humanitarian support as needed and as much as is needed.
But the sudden ramp up, almost like flipping a switch, suggests Israel could have done a lot more, a lot sooner.
Well, I think it was never seen to be a priority. I mean, I think for them it's the war aims, the objectives of the war. That was first and foremost. We would be seen as a sort of a second priority or even a nuisance value.
Data from UNRWA, the UN's main agency in Gaza, shows that Israel has steadily allowed more aid into Gaza since opening up humanitarian crossings on October 21st, with the exception of February, when the number of aid trucks dropped to less than 100 per day, before slowly increasing again in March. But those numbers are all well below the 500 humanitarian aid and commercial trucks that entered Gaza every day before the war. The impact of insufficient aid has been obvious for months. It is marked all over the emaciated face of little Leila Junaid. Barely 3 months old, she is among the 30% of children in northern Gaza who are suffering from acute malnutrition and who desperately need more aid now.
And while we've started to see Israel follow through on some of the commitments it made to the United States about allowing more humanitarian aid into Gaza, some other steps like the opening of the port of Ashdod have yet to happen. And also Israel's commitments in terms of better coordination with those humanitarian groups to deconflict between those aid operations and military operations. A lot of that still remains to be seen to what extent Israel will follow through and to what extent it will actually improve the situation in Gaza. Julia.
Vital reporting. Jeremy, thank you for bringing it to us. Jeremy Diamond there. Now, former U.S. President Donald Trump and House Speaker Mike Johnson holding a news conference discussing election security. Johnson calling for a bill to prevent non-citizens from voting, something the law already prohibits, and without producing evidence that it happens pretty often.
What we're going to do is introduce legislation to require that every single person who registers to vote in a federal election must prove that they're an American citizen first. They have to prove it. That will be a new part of the federal law and a very important one. Our bill will establish new safeguards. It'll put us on par, by the way, with virtually every other democracy around the world that also prohibits non-citizen voting.
Okay, the speaker's visit to Mar-a-Lago coincides with an ongoing effort to oust him, led by one of Trump's staunchest allies in Congress, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. Just listen to what the former president had to say. And,
we're getting along very well with the speaker, and I get along very well with Marjorie. We have a speaker. He was voted in, and it was a complicated process, and I think it's not an easy situation for any speaker. I think he's doing a very good job. He's doing about as good as you're going to do. And I'm sure that Marjorie understands that. She's a very good friend of mine. And I know she has a lot of respect for the speaker.
Meanwhile, Vice President Kamala Harris is in the battleground state of Arizona. She's there to speak about abortion rights and took to the stage just moments ago. This week, the Arizona Supreme Court cleared the way to revive a Civil War era law that bans nearly all abortions.
Now, in states across our country, extremists have proposed and passed laws that criminalize doctors and punish women. Laws that threaten doctors and nurses with prison time, even for life, simply for providing reproductive care. And then just this week, here in Arizona, they have turned back the clock to the 1800s. To take away a woman's most fundamental right, the right to make decisions about her own body.
And senior political analyst Ron Brownstein joins us now. Ron, we'll begin in Arizona. The Democrats clearly understanding that this is a political potent weapon that they've been handed in Arizona this week, and Kamala Harris wasting no time getting there to front that message.
Absolutely. If you look at kind of the big picture of this election, Donald Trump right now has a very large lead over President Joe Biden over who can best handle the economy. Biden can probably close that gap somewhat, but he's not likely to eliminate it, Julia, by Election Day, which means that ultimately he has to convince some voters who think that Trump is better for their bottom line to vote against him anyway on other grounds. And abortion rights and democracy, the kind of complex of issues around rights and values and democracy, clearly is his best opportunity to do that. And if you look at some of these swing states, what we saw in 2022 in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Arizona was that there was a clear majority of voters who want to keep abortion legal in that state. There's been a lot of pessimism in Democratic ranks about Biden's prospects in Arizona. I think all of that dramatically changed this week.
Zip back to Mar-a-Lago and the former president speaking there with House Speaker Mike Johnson. And he was asked why he won't, if he wins power again, sign a federal abortion ban. He said he won't. Why should we believe him was the question. He said we broke Roe v. Wade, which was the overturning, of course, of that law by the Supreme Court. You can see the Democratic ad campaign there. We broke Roe v. Wade. How is he handling this, in your estimation? Because he was again asked whether he was pro-choice or pro-life. And he sort of said, you know where I stand on this. But he didn't say where he stands.
Well, he's clearly looking to limit the political damage. I mean, you don't have to be kind of a seer to understand, as I said, that in these swing states, there is a clear majority that wants to keep abortion legal. And he's trying to minimize the danger to his campaign on that issue by saying that he would not sign a national abortion ban. He's got two big problems with that. One is that, as you say, he is simultaneously taking credit for overturning the national right to abortion. And so basically asking voters who believe abortion should be legal to put their trust that Trump would veto a ban if a Republican Congress sent it to him, may be asking a little much. The other front though is important. And it was significant that Kamala Harris mentioned this today in a way that she has not before, which is that even without signing a national abortion ban, there's enormous leeway for the next president through executive branch action at the Food and Drug Administration and the Department of Justice to reduce or even potentially virtually eliminate access to abortion nationwide. And Trump allies have made very clear they expect him to use the FDA, for example, to restrict the availability of medication abortion, or to use the Justice Department to revive a 19th century law that could ban the interstate mail of any medical tool used in abortions. And she brought that up today. Even if he tries to fudge the issue of whether he would sign a national abortion ban, that does not eliminate the potential ways in which he could restrict availability. And you can bet Democrats are going to make voters aware of that, particularly in these key swing states.
Yeah, there's another campaign ad. Very quickly, the other thing, you understood why the speaker got that ticket, that plane ticket to Mar-a-Lago, because he was praised, of course, by the former president. And we know as a speaker, he's under some degree of pressure. Some of that ties to funding for Ukraine and for Israel, which has been a battle in Congress. The former president floated some idea of perhaps a loan to Ukraine rather than gifting them the money. How do you see that flying?
Well, I mean, Trump has been saying that for months. Ultimately, that is not going to break the logjam because there's, you know, essentially no chance of the Democratic-controlled Senate or the White House agreeing to that. Mike Johnson, as on many issues here, has to make the choice between placating the far right of his caucus or working with Democrats to build a bipartisan coalition to do something that most Americans support, in this case, providing further aid to Ukraine. The indications are that he is going to try to find a way to in fact get that aid flowing again. But each time he does this, he puts himself further out on that ledge where a handful of Republicans could depose him. Trump's tap on the shoulder, though, should help insulate him against that.
Wow, it's going to be an interesting few months. Ron, great to have you with us. Ron Brownstein there. Great to have you on the show, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, the former interpreter of Japanese baseball superstar Shohei Ohtani has surrendered to federal authorities in the United States. I believe he's literally just been released on bond. Ippei Mizuhara is facing federal bank fraud charges for allegedly stealing more than $16 million from the Dodgers star to support his gambling activities. Prosecutors say they have recordings of him impersonating Ohtani on calls with the bank in order to transfer money from Ohtani's accounts. Nick Watt is following the case from Los Angeles for us. I think it's a 37-page criminal complaint against him. You're presumed innocent until proven guilty, Nick, but this is pretty damning. He is, though, out on bond. Do we know how much for?
Just $25,000. They clearly don't think he's a flight risk. You know, it started badly. He had to shuffle into court in leg shackles. The judge let him take those off. One of the other conditions of his release, he's not allowed to gamble. He's not allowed to speak to any bookmakers. And he has to have gambling addiction treatment. His lawyer said he was planning to have that anyway. You mentioned 37 pages. You know, a number of very interesting parts of that. As you mentioned, he was allegedly impersonating Shohei Ohtani with bank officials. Also, some fascinating exchanges on text between the interpreter and the bookie. In one, the bookmaker, this was last fall, clearly when he was worried about getting paid, the bookie texted the interpreter and said, "I am in Newport Beach right now. I am watching Shohei Ohtani walking his dog. And if you don't get in touch with me, I'm going to go up and speak to Shohei Ohtani and ask him for a better contact number for you." There was another one from March 20th when all this was sort of breaking, in which the bookie asks the interpreter, "Obviously, you didn't steal from him." And the reply from the interpreter is, "Well, technically, I did steal from him. It's all over for me." Meanwhile, Shohei Ohtani is playing very, very well at baseball. He has actually setting some career records for himself. The Dodgers are doing really well. So clearly he has not been troubled by this. And the other thing that's clear in that 37-page complaint is that Ohtani really had no idea what was going on here. But the sums of money are staggering. So apparently over about a two-year period, this guy, Ippei Mizuhara, won $140 million betting on sports. He lost $180 million betting on sports. So he was in a $40 million hole. Now, right now we're told that he stole $16 million from Shohei Ohtani. Unclear where the other 24 million is. But anyway, he's going to be back in court in a couple of weeks. Meantime, he's out on bond and he's been told to get a job. Julia?
Yeah. I mean, what's astonishing to me is some private wealth manager didn't call up Shohei and go, you're taking a lot of money out here. You know, when's it coming back? But yeah, anyway, no time to answer.
They didn't see it.
Yeah.
They didn't see it. They were shielded from it.
Great to have you with us. Thank you, Nick Watt there. Great to chat to you. All right, coming up, Wall Street sell-off, the biggest one-day drop for US stocks in months, Mideast tensions hurting sentiment, the very latest just ahead. Plus, EU antitrust chief Margrethe Vestager puts AI giants on notice. She says robust regulation is coming. She also believes AI will change everything. And AI may not be coming for your job, but could it shorten your work week? Yes, please. The findings from a new CEO survey after this.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
Lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back into all our viewers in the US, UK and Latin America. We hope you're having a fabulous Friday. And to all our first movers across Asia, here's hoping your weekend is off to a super start. I have to say, though, it was a rough Friday on Wall Street, and that's what tops our money move today. US stocks suffering one of their worst days of the year, with all the major averages dropping more than 1%, as you can see. The Nasdaq giving back nearly all of its gains from Thursday when it hit a record high. Concern that Iran may carry out an imminent attack against Israeli targets, a top concern for investors, especially going into the weekend. And that was reflected in the price of oil. Just take a look at this. Both US and Brent crude rising around 0.5%. They'd been up more than 2% intraday, hitting six-month highs. And all of that, of course, playing into ongoing inflationary concerns. It was also an unspectacular start to Q1 earnings season. JP Morgan, the largest US bank, issuing weak guidance on the profits it makes from loans and mortgages, better known as net interest margin, NIM. But as we say here on First Move, perhaps too often, context is everything. The S&P and the Nasdaq still up more than 8% year to date, driven in part by the spectacular rise in artificial intelligence and the growth story it presents. And we see that playing out across all sorts of global economies around the globe. One very real threat to AI, however, though, could perhaps come from governments. EU Antitrust Commissioner Margrethe Vestager telling our Richard Quest Friday that officials cannot make the same mistake they did with big tech and wait too long to regulate. Just listen to this.
When it comes to artificial intelligence, it is indeed not just another new technology. It's a new world. It will change everything. And when you have that kind of potential, obviously, you have the equivalent risks. Important steps have been taken. We have our AI law in Europe, but that's the first. For other jurisdictions, we have the code of practices, we have the presidential order here, but we need to move forward, and obviously we need to implement to make sure that this is not just words on paper, but real obligation that AI developers take upon themselves.
There's a real risk, because this is one of the reasons you're here, of course, as part of the regular discussions that take place, that everybody's doing their own thing. And whilst intentions may be good, you end up with a fragmented tapestry of different rules and regulations, which we already have in the digital world, that could be made a great deal worse under AI.
Yes, and I think everybody realizes that. We came, in my opinion, too late into regulate what is now big tech, because we got a lot of entrenched market power, very few opportunities for the newcomers, for the competitors, actually to get to their customers. And I think everybody realized that we cannot make that mistake again. So we need to figure out how to align not only with friends in the US, but also globally.
You see, I hear what you're saying, and I know this is sort of the way governance works, but it's working a great deal slower than the technological advancements. And that is your core problem. You can't keep up with the advancements.
No, and this is exactly why the focus should not be on regulating technology in itself, but should focus on regulating the use of technology. Because the use cases of technology, they're much more stable than the technology, because technology is developing as we speak. There will be another generation of whatever model we are talking about. But the use cases, the risk that people are being discriminated when applying for university, trying to get a mortgage, wanting to insure themselves, getting proper health treatment, those use cases, they are there and they will remain with us no matter the level of AI sophistication.
And Richard Quest joins us now. Richard, I love her point about regulating the use of technology rather than the technology itself, because technology moves too fast, as you said. But I just think investors laugh at that. Look how well they did with social media, or aren't doing, quite frankly. But even the enthusiasm in AI stocks, not enough to outweigh the nervous sentiment that we saw across markets, across assets in the session today and this week.
Yeah, but that's knee-jerk as a result of geopolitical oil. Don't forget the dollar's storming ahead, best quarter for the dollar for a long time, and worries about inflation and cutting of interest rates. So when I say, I don't mean to belittle those elements, but that is the sort of meat and veg, if you will, of a cyclical recovery, and will work its way through. They say about Margarita Vestager, she's never met a regulation or an antitrust action that she doesn't like. They say that, you know, she is one of those reasons that Europe does not have a global player like Google or Meta or Apple, because Europe is an unfriendly environment. Now, she bristles at that, absolutely bristles, and says, no, it's all to do with capital, it's all to do with startups, et cetera, et cetera. But I was talking to a very senior executive who in a top, top tech company, who basically said, no, because Europe is not considered to be friendly enough.
Tech companies have been telling us both for the last 10 years that you get mummified in red tape. And I understand their desire to do something about this, but the danger is that they suppress innovation and that they over-regulate. And the United States, even though they're in discussions with them, end up allowing this innovation to flourish and the EU gets left behind once again. Richard, I think your point is so valid on this. Jamie Dimon, interesting this week as well. Did you see the comments that he made when he said, our children are going to live to 100, they're not going to suffer from cancer, and they're going to work 3.5 days a week as a result of artificial intelligence?
I am old enough to remember the whole 4-day week in France, and everybody had a good old chortle. And the idea, because, you know, the lazy French, they never done a full week's work in their life. And yet, you know, that is where we're moving. This survey by KPMG of CEOs that shows most CEOs, 2/3 of them, are playing around with some sort of idea of 4-day weeks or lower working weeks. It's merely backing up what the UK study did last year. This is the one from the US, 30% are exploring it because they know it works. This is one of those things, Julia. All the research shows, and there was a massive study in the UK last year, which showed 61 companies, of which the majority have kept some form of lower week working, and then some form because employers like it, employees like it. Now, Don't get me wrong, it's got to be structured properly. You can't just say, well, you're off next Friday for the next 6 months. You've got to work out who's going to do the work, how long, is it this or it's that or the other.
I'm thinking generative AI can do the work, Richard. If we're all that much more productive, then maybe...
No, stop.
I'm fully prepared to be replaced by AI Julia for a couple of days.
The danger
is it becomes five.
Exactly. Yeah. It wouldn't be a couple of days. Once they discovered that AI Quest... can do the job as well. And not only that. AI Quest can do your job, my job. It could probably do Zane's job. Just wrap them all in. And it can probably do it in about five different languages, which none of us speak.
I'm going to start Googling what to do when I retire, Richard.
There's one thing I always say, and I say it half in jest, but I'm glad I'm at this end of my career, not that end.
Do you really think we're going to be replaced by AI, Richard?
In some shape or form, at some point, yes.
But not this week.
Oh, God forbid.
It's Friday.
I've got a mortgage to pay.
Have a good weekend.
Have a good weekend.
I'm just going to erase this. I hope our bosses weren't watching. What a disaster of monumental proportions. Exactly. What didn't happen?
Blame Margarita Vestager. That's the answer. Blame Margarita Vestager.
We need more regulation. You and I are now both in favour of mass regulation. There you go. Richard, thank you. Have a great weekend. All right, turning now to the weather. It's been a bit of a dreary day here in New York, but temperatures... the good news is they're warming up across Europe and Asia. Chad Myers joins us now for more on this almost summery weekend. Chad, you've had to follow Richard again.
My
friend.
I don't even want to talk about AI because I finally learned how to make an AI image today. It's my very first one. And loved it. I loved it. It
just
text to image. And now I have a puppy on a bed with a lightning storm behind him. And I didn't have to draw it.
Congrats.
Thanks. Here, some showers moving into Shanghai over the next couple of days, and then eventually into Seoul. The rain does go away, and really it's going to be a fairly nice couple of days, well above normal for most of us here. And even the showers here south of Shanghai will be in a not-so-populated area. Temperatures are mainly in the 20s. This is 5 to 10 degrees above normal for this time of year. And even as we work our way into the weekend, things aren't going to be too bad for next weekend either. We're going to start to be in the 20s. One cool day for you, Beijing, down to 18 with a rainy day on Sunday. A couple cool days in Seoul, the same rain will move to you. Back toward Europe, we are going to see a couple of windy days for Dublin and also all of the UK, but it warms up in parts of France. It warms up in Germany for one more day, for 36 more hours, and then a cold front comes in and kind of ruins the whole summer kind of party. But it is pollen season for a lot of folks. Take the cold front, push the pollen away, and you will breathe a whole lot easier. So look where we are from Paris, from 27 to 12. Take that.
Wow. We're ready for a pollen push in New York. Definitely. Everyone's sneezing. Chad, have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Yep. You're watching First Move. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to First Move and a return to our top story today. The world waiting to see how Iran retaliates against Israel following that attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus last week. U.S. President Joe Biden telling reporters Friday he expects an attack happening, quote, sooner than later. For months, there have been fears that an attack by Iran or one of its proxies like Hezbollah could escalate violence already heightened by the war in Gaza. And just hours ago, Hezbollah militants in Lebanon fired dozens of rockets toward Israel. Now, for more, we're joined by Alex Vitanka. He's director of the Middle East Institute's Iran program. Alex, great to have you on the show. I think Iran has telegraphed that they feel like some form of retaliation or response is required. But the challenge is finding an option here that doesn't create some kind of trigger for a wider conflict in the region, something that Iran has spent decades trying to avoid. Is there any reason to suggest that Iran has changed their stance in that regard, or they still want to avoid that?
Great to be with you. You know, I tend to believe that that's not the case. It hasn't changed. Iran's strategic mission, if you will, vis-a-vis Israel is the same. If you want to fight Israel, just fight Israel through proxy warfare, because if you fight the Israelis directly head on, you are going to eventually risk to have to fight the Americans, which the Islamic Republic has no desire to do because it kind of knows the outcome of such a conflict, and it would risk the survival of the Islamic Republic. And the other thing that has happened in recent months after the attack by Hamas on the state of Israel and the Israeli intervention in Gaza is that the Iranians are reading this situation in the following way, that time is on their side, Israel is undermining itself, that public opinion in the region, perhaps internationally, is turning against Israel. So why risk it? Why do anything radical like regional war when time is on their side? Having said all that, the attack on 1st of April on their embassy in Damascus was very different. So they're in a position right now where they have to do something to save face.
It's interesting that you make the point that, that they won't look to perhaps take the spotlight off Israel and what is an increasingly unpopular activity that we're seeing with the violence in Gaza and sort of turn that attention on themselves, which I think is an important point to make at this moment. Do we look to the precedent then that was set with the U.S. killing of Iranian General Soleimani back in 2020 and how they chose to respond in that case, non-lethal attacks on U.S. bases? Does that give us some kind of perhaps comparison for response?
In many ways, yes. But here's the problem with the conflict with Israel. There aren't that many open sort of targets, if you will. There are Israeli bases in the region as such. The Israelis are there, but you know, United States has about 50,000 American troops from Syria all the way to Oman scattered around the region. There are plenty of American targets. That was the case with Qasem Soleimani in January 2020, not so with Israel. And I have to say, the last 12 days, the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, has made life difficult for himself because he's made the point repeatedly that Israel, by attacking the embassy in Damascus, targeted Iran on Iranian soil because of its diplomatic position, and that Iran has to retaliate in kind. Number two, that they killed Iranians, Iranian officers, and Iran has to do the same. Really making it hard for himself now to get out of that pickle that I think he's created for himself.
Alex, very quickly, do you expect in some manner the Iranians to be communicating with the Americans at this point to give them a sense of what the plan is and then for the Americans to be able to talk to the Israelis and say, don't respond, just in order to try and keep a lid on this?
Right. Exactly right. That's exactly what happened with the Iranian retaliation after Qasem Soleimani. They told the Iraqis, tell your American friends, this is what we're going to do. Get their soldiers out. And they fired those missiles.
Right.
Whether the United States can do that this time, whether Biden has that political capital with Benjamin Netanyahu, remains to be seen. But I think a controlled end to this escalation is what the Iranian side clearly is after.
Yeah, controlled and a non-lethal attack, right, to your point. Exactly. Alex, great to chat to you, sir. Thank you. Alex Fatanka there of the Middle East Institute. All right, meanwhile, in the occupied West Bank, hundreds of armed Israeli settlers stormed a village, according to Palestinian officials who say at least one person was killed, 25 others injured, and several homes and cars burned. That would make it one of the largest attacks by settlers this year. The IDF says violent riots were instigated in several locations following the search for a missing Israeli teen. And coming up here on First Move, an exclusive look at efforts to stop illegal migration into the United States. This time, it's coming from the Mexican side of the border. More on Mexico's enforcement escalation after this.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to an exclusive first look at how Mexico is trying to tackle illegal crossings into the U.S. And we're talking checkpoints and inspection camps at some of the busiest entry points. Mexican officials say it's helped deter migration to the United States by 10% since December. Our David Culver spent some time with border guards, and this is what he found.
You can see behind me here, there's a huge gap in the wall. And this is where Mexican officials tell us that a lot of the smugglers are either directing or bringing some of the migrants to so that they can easily cross.
which makes these rugged back roads the preferred and profitable routes for cartel-backed migrant smugglers. Okay. We're about an hour east of Tijuana, driving with Mexican migration officials along the U.S.-Mexico border. But we detour after learning a group of migrants has been rescued, as officials here say.
¿De dónde son?
Brasil.
De Brasil.
We pull up and find about a dozen folks who describe to me their attempts to claim asylum in the U.S.
He said he tried to cross, but Mexican officials stopped him from being able to go.
That's because Mexico is now stepping up its efforts to stop migrants from crossing illegally into the U.S.
We don't know if it was on that.
Following requests from the Biden administration, Mexico is now pouring resources, like the National Guard and Mexican Army, in to help patrol and detain migrants like these, eventually transporting them to southern Mexico.
Where we separate them by nationalities, and then from them we determine the deportation process.
What's happening here goes beyond stepped-up patrols. In recent months, Mexican officials have built base camps, deploying troops to some of the most popular illegal crossing sites.
Hey, smuggler's van. Are there several of these vehicles just left abandoned in...
Like seven vehicles in total.
In this area.
In the area.
As we pull up, we realize we've been here before.
We've seen so many people cross through this property. This right here.
Uh-huh.
At this spot late last year, we met U.S. residents fed up with migrants coming through their land.
They can come through the front door.
Our cameras captured hundreds each day and night.
That has stopped in recent weeks, and it stopped primarily because of what we're seeing on the Mexico side of things. This is a remote base on the border. You've got Mexican immigration officials, you've got National Guard, and you've got Mexican Army who are here 24/7.
We have our fridge, microwave, coffee, everything.
You have moved resources to live 24/7 on the border. Why is it so important for Mexico to be doing that?
We want to prevent migrants to get in touch with the criminal groups.
The number of migrant encounters reported by U.S. Border Patrol appears to reflect the impact of Mexico's actions, dropping 42% from December to January alone and seeming to stay low. But officials warn cartels and their smugglers frequently adjust their tactics and keep close watch.
They're watching us right now.
They see when we are patrolling and when we leave a spot.
It's a crisis that has also sparked uneasiness for Mexican residents.
It's gotten so frustrating for these folks in particular that the community got together, wrote a letter to their governor petitioning for more resources. And it's for that reason that you have, well, you can see right here, members of the Mexican National Guard who are now patrolling neighborhoods like this one to keep migrants from coming through.
Authorities here urge migrants to use the U.S.'s CBP1 app rather than to risk crossing with smugglers. Mexican officials at this location even help pre-screen up to 500 migrants daily for the U.S. asylum interview process.
So he's in communication with U.S. officials, por otro lado, and on the other side, and they're sending documents back and forth to make sure that they have the right information.
While this is a more orderly way to claim asylum, it can take a while to get an appointment. Marta Achila says she's waited 5 months for this day.
Pero no quisieran usar un coyote para cruzar.
Ay, pues no
directamente.
Tenemos dinero.
Y quieren trabajar legalmente allá en los Estados Unidos.
Entonces, eso
queremos. So I asked why they didn't go through the smuggling route, which so many choose to do. Vamos a caminar con ustedes. And she said that, for one, it cost an extreme amount of money. And the other aspect of it for her was they wanted to be able to enter legally through the appointment, try to build a better future there.
The road ahead is uncertain for both the migrants and for those protecting the border. We see that firsthand as we leave the remote border camps.
The reason we've stopped and pulled over is because there are these spikes that we've noticed all along the different dirt roadways that take us to the border wall.
Evidence of a smuggler's desperate attempt to salvage their profits.
There are dozens, if not hundreds, of these.
And while it slows them down momentarily, for now they forge ahead in their efforts to curb the flow of a migrant crisis that's consuming resources on both sides of the border.
And just into CNN, a transitional council has been established in Haiti. It's responsible for choosing the country's next leadership, according to a decree. This comes a month after the Haitian prime minister announced he would step down once the council names a new prime minister. People hope the move will help quell turmoil in the nation, where most of the capital remains under the grip of gangs. Any further details or which members and which individuals are on that council, we will bring them to you. For now, coming up next, a Masters record for Tiger Woods. We'll have all the action from day two from Augusta. Stay with us. Welcome back. A stunning performance from Tiger Woods at the Masters on a marathon second day for golfers at the Augusta National, which broke the record for the most consecutive cuts made at a tournament for a staggering 24th time. The 48-year-old will play the weekend seeking a historic sixth victory in Georgia. Dom Riddell is there with all the action for us. Dare we dream? Dare he dream? He said he's got one more green jacket in him, but even if he doesn't, this is huge, yeah. Don.
Hey, Juliet. Well, he's dreaming. He certainly thinks he's very much in contention, but whatever happens, it already has been an historic day here at Augusta. Just absolutely extraordinary. And when you think about everything that Tiger Woods has been through, the accident which could have cost him his leg or maybe even his life 3 years ago, and ever since then we've seen him kind of dragging his body up and down golf courses, grimacing and wincing in pain, he looks so much better now. He had a long day on Friday because he didn't get his first round finished on Thursday, so he had to be up at the crack of dawn or earlier to play five holes to finish the first round. Then he had to play another 18, which meant 23 holes in one day. Before this tournament, he'd only played 24 holes competitively all season. So a marathon day for Tiger Woods. But he's got there. He's made the cut, as you say, for a 24th consecutive time. And now he's thinking about much more than just history.
I'm tired. I've been off for a while. Competing, grinding, it's been a long 23 holes, a long day. But Lance and I really did some good fighting today and we got a chance.
Tiger using all of his smarts and experience to get around this golf course. The conditions have been really, really difficult, very, very windy. But he was playing today as if there was no wind at all, just hitting the fairway almost every single time. And he's given himself a chance of doing something this weekend. We'll see. But it's great that he's still here.
We've got a chance. That sounds like Tiger. Long day, longer weekend ahead, Don. What does the leaderboard look like right now?
Well, three other Americans are at the top. Max Homer, who is a successful PGA Tour player, but he doesn't tend to feature very often in the majors. He is currently in a three-way tie on six under par. The two men alongside him already have major victory success. So we've got the current world number one and 2022 Masters champion, Scottie Scheffler. He's actually still out on the course. He's got a few holes left to complete, but he is also there on six under. As is Bryson DeChambeau, who is the 2020 US Open champion. He has left the PGA Tour for the LIV Tour in the last couple of years. He is one of the most fascinating men in golf. He was known as the golf scientist. He's always got a different approach to the game. He's kind of rubbed people up the wrong way. He's one of those polarizing figures that you either love or you hate, but he's playing very, very well as well on this golf course. So at the moment, a three-way tie with three American golfers, but there's a couple of other guys lurking with intent behind them, and I think we're all set for an exciting day tomorrow.
Yes, stiff competition. Come on, Tiger. Don Riddell, thank you so much for that. Enjoy it.
All right.
And that just about wraps up the show. Thank you for joining us. Have a fantastic weekend, and I'll see you on Monday or Tuesday.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.